Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Devin Brisky about the new book she co-authored with Johan Swinnen entitled Beeronomics, How Beer Explains the World. Devin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
We're happy to have you on. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Something about myself. Well, I'm currently in Tucson, Arizona, visiting a friend, and I'm under a blanket so we get good sound for this audio interview. I also have a podcast called Religion and Socialism that I work on with the Democratic Socialists of America. So that's not beer related, but figured I would throw it in there.
So what led you to write this book? It seems like quite a leap from doing that podcast to doing a book about beer.
Yeah, well, the podcast is just a hobby. I had some background in food journalism, and Professor Swinnen contacted me, and he actually knows my mother. She works at Stanford, and he was a visiting professor there, and he had previously written an academic book about the economics of beer and done a lot of research on beer markets, and he wanted to turn it into kind of a popular read version for a more mainstream audience. So I had a background in food journalism, and we made the connection and just decided to work on the project together. And we actually wrote most of the book 5 years ago. That was the last time I was working on it full time. And since then, it's just been like editing and updating because so much has happened in the beer world since then. Like acquisitions have happened. Every time I saw the news and it was like AB InBev, SAB Miller merger, I'm like, shoot, that totally screws up that chapter. Like we have to write a big addendum. That's been happening since then.
I have to say that definitely doesn't come across in the book. It's a very smooth process through the history and development of the beer industry. It really was a fascinating read.
Oh, thank you.
You begin the book by explaining just how central of a role beer has played throughout human history. I was wondering if you could start us off by explaining a bit as to how far back beer goes and how it changed from its early years as we know it through the records through what it became in the centuries that followed.
The history of beer is really the history of civilization. So you start to see that the earliest evidence we have of beer drinking is in early Mesopotamia in the Fertile Crescent, which is when people started moving to an agrarian planned agricultural economy. And one of beer is mentioned in the very earliest written work we ever have, the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it's written as there is this sort of beast man, Enkidu, and in the book, he becomes a man. And part of that process is drinking beer and becoming unruly. And that's actually the thing that civilizes him. So beer and civilization are very closely tied together, mostly because of this connection it has to agriculture and moving towards a settled down, planned economy. And you see that they drank beer in ancient Egypt. It was part of the grain economy there with the Nile, and then throughout early Europe with the barbarians and the ancient Germanic tribes. And it's only when you see the great wine divide between the Greeks and the Romans and the Northern Europeans that drank beer. And it's interesting because the Greeks were actually the first civilization to grow grain but not ferment it into beer. They only drank wine. So yeah, alcohol is very tied to civilization. And when you get into the Middle Ages, you start to see that it's also became a big way that governments had power, because the governments that were most effective were the ones that figured out good taxation strategies, and alcohol was always taxed. So the taxation of alcohol was a big part of basically the economy and war in European history.
One of the points you make early in the book, though, is that this is not the beer that we are familiar with today at our supermarkets or our homebrew. It's a very different type of beer, and it played a very different role in diets back then.
Yeah, so in the first place that brew, or the first organizations, I guess you could say, in recorded history that brewed beer on anything close to what we would consider scale were monasteries. And they were basically like groups of guys that for some reason could not get married. And they would get to, and so their parents paid to have them join, and they would brew massive amounts of beer. And they drank massive amounts of beer, and they also they would brew beer several times over. So the first brew would be the strongest, and the lower brews would be the weakest beers, and those would be like ones they give to peasants and children. And it because the water was so bad then, and they didn't have the modern science to understand why, they did understand that when it was brewed and fermented, it would be a hydrating, something that is hydrating that would not give them diseases.
You also pointed out that it was an important part of their daily caloric content, that for a lot of them, it wasn't a supplement, it was actually part of their nutritional intake.
Yeah, it was very important substance.
Now, you mentioned the link with monasteries and how they get involved in this business. And one of the threads in the book that you return to at a couple points is how some of them are actually involved in this today. And that gets to this point that you make in the book about how we're seeing in some ways that this very dichotomous development in the beer industry. I wonder if you could take us through that. Basically, how do we go from what we might think of as home brewing, these monasteries brewing? Where does the modern day beer industry come from in that respect?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because currently there's this real mystique around beer brewed in monasteries. Like Trappist beer is exploding all around the world, beer brewed in Trappist monasteries in Belgium, and it's great, but it's interesting because part of the mystique is this idea that this is the true craft beer and it's part of this ancient tradition and it's small batches, and it's different from the Budweiser or Stella Artois that are like these giant industrial lagers that craft beer people have come to frown upon. And that's ironic because, as I said before, back in the day, beer brewed in monasteries was actually like the biggest scale brewing operations they had. So yeah, right now we're pretty much during the 20th century, you saw, or basically dating back to the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution, you saw all these technological developments that really, really changed the beer industry. So automated bottling, the steam engine, transportation, innovation in basically every aspect of the brewing process. And as part of that, the dominant beer became lager, which is bottom fermented, and it was good industrially because you could brew it in large batches and it'd be clear and pure and simple, and people thought that was really great, as opposed to ales, which were a lot more complicated and traditionally brewed by pub masters or cafe, in small batches in communities around Europe, in towns around Europe, that really were usually people were working with what they had. Like they would kind of, it was a craft in that they would really determine what they had and what they could do. And this batch would be very different from that batch, and nothing was standardized. So all that changed with the Industrial Revolution, and you start to see these massive, massive breweries brewing at scale in Europe and in the US. In the US, it was a lot more dramatic, though. And you see pretty much the market dominated in the early 1980s. 90% of the beer brewed in the US was brewed by Anheuser-Busch, now AB InBev, Miller, or Coors. So three really recognizable lager brands. And in Europe, there's also massive consolidation too, but just not on the same scale. There are still a lot more smaller breweries. And then since pretty much beginning in the 1990s, you start to see this change in the market structure where craft beer becomes a lot more popular. And we're seeing that all around the world now. And now there's this sort of dual industry where there's the big at scale industrial lager brewers, and then there are small craft breweries, and then periodically there are shakeouts. There was one in the late 90s, and then there's a trend of the large scale industrial brewers buying the small craft brewers when they reach a certain scale and using them to kind of bolster their own, because they see it as an emerging marketplace and something that they really need to be tapped into, that they need for their own growth. The popularity of that industrial lager is falling in the traditionally beer drinking countries. Meanwhile, it's actually growing in non-traditional beer drinking countries like China and Brazil.
It's interesting how the move toward industrial brewed lagers reflected different priorities back then, because when you see that in the 19th and early 20th centuries, as you describe in the book, the beer could be a very questionable quality. You could get a great brew, you could get a bad brew, and it was really hit or miss. There was no real metric of judging it. So in that sense, industrial brews provided a consistent quality, as you describe. And nowadays, we tend to, you know, people that we no longer have to worry about that sense of that this, you know, might be foul tasting. There's much more a sense of that that's the more attractive brew, whereas previously it was the more off-putting one.
Yeah, exactly. And you see this in Belgium. Belgium was such an incredible place to live and learn about the culture there, because beer is such a huge part of the culture. And it's really interesting because I think right now people really think about Belgium as like the place with the best beer in the world. And the beer there is just the highest quality. And they have UNESCO World Heritage recognition for the heritage that they have with their brews. But ironically, during the 20th century, so lager, which is a German style and is basically the Budweiser and the Stella Artois, was introduced there during World War I, during German occupation. And it quickly became very like preferable to the really small batch styles that were traditional, and every single little village had their own unique style and their own unique flavors and spices and way of doing things. And it just grew to totally dominate the country. And during the course of researching this book, I met this man named Frank Boone. He was one of my favorite characters. He talks about how basically when he was growing up, it was Stella Artois had grown to be huge, and they saw it. They were like, it's like a Christmas star. It's, you know, yellow. It's like, it's so clear and fresh and totally standardized. It's the same thing. You always know what you're getting. That's so different from like the cafe and the random guy down the street that's brewing a kind of different batch every single time. And he had the exact opposite reaction, which is like, no, like we must preserve these styles that are just part of our heritage, and they're so unique and they're so specific to Belgium, and specifically like little towns like the town of Hoegaarden with their white beer with the, you know, the cinnamon and the orange. And so he actually bought a brewery from these two really old people, René de Witz and his sister, and they ran it all by hand. And it was the style of beer was making this goose, which is the spontaneous fermentation beer. So it's aged, and it basically, you don't have standardized yeast that you use. It's not like a clean process. It's like it ferments based on the yeast in the air. So it's very tied to the place. So, and he says his uncle worked at Stella Artois, and he said to him, like, you think that this, like, you're going to invest in this beer? Like, these are dying. Like, they're going to be over. Like, Stella is the future. Like, there's only going to be lager. And he just didn't care. And him and a couple other people really worked to preserve these styles. And their big innovation was that they said, I'm not going, because all the breweries are basically saying, okay, we need to make this beer cheaper and cut corners to compete with Stella because they're brewing at scale and they could brew it a lot cheaper. And he said, no, I'm going to make it really high quality. I'm going to use the best ingredients and I'm going to charge a lot of money. And he struggled for a while, and now his Goose is like shipped worldwide. He says he still has this tiny brewery in Limbeek, Belgium, and he's like shipping beer to Japan and Costa Rica. Like, he's a completely global business with a really high end prestige beer. And there are so many stories like that in Belgium of just people deciding, like, we really need to preserve these styles.
That story there explained is not just unique to Belgium. As you explained, it's, you see that trend in the United States as well, how as the beer industry expanded, especially after Prohibition came to an end, that a lot of these smaller brewers tried to make that, were engaged in that ultimately failed effort to try to one up the big brewers in terms of advertising and how it didn't work for them. So they ended up going out of business. Mm-hmm. But then, as you describe with the craft brewers, the resurgence in the 1980s and 1990s, as you explained, it has a lot to do with the idea that beer consumption isn't going up, but people wanted better beer.
They wanted more variety. Yeah. They were sick of lager. You know, they had there are other changes too. It wasn't just that. It was actually a change in taxation policy. We can all thank Jimmy Carter for changing the way that breweries were taxed in a way that benefited smaller breweries. So there was that. And then there was also another big factor was actually the advertising market. So one of the main reason why the US consolidated at a rate that you didn't see anywhere else in the world in terms of just a massive shakeout and the number of breweries just plummeting and all of our beer from these massive macro breweries that were by far the biggest in the world is because of the television advertising market. So beer was very tied to sports and their advertising in the way they market it in the US. So prior to television, small local breweries would basically advertise by sponsoring minor league baseball teams and it's still beer. The beer market in the US is very tied to sports markets. So you turn on Sunday Night Football and every single commercial is about beer. And when there is a shift to television advertising, the potential people that you could reach through one ad really favored these breweries that were able to brew at scale. So the ads became cheaper per customer that they could potentially reach. And we've compared the way the consolidation in the US happened to the way it happened in Europe. And a lot of it has to do with the spread of television advertising and TV being a lot more regulated in Europe, and especially Germany, where the consolidation was not anywhere close to what happened in the US. It was on the lower end of things.
You mentioned that how that played a factor in that you didn't see as much commercial advertising in television. So you just simply, there wasn't as much of an opportunity for large brewers to monopolize advertising and to basically drown out the smaller ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really had to do with the cost per viewer. So if you are a brewery and you can supply, you know, a town of like 50,000 people, and then there's one brewer over that can supply, you know, a town like a city of a million people, then if the main way to reach your audience is through television advertising, and that's how people are consuming sports, and that's, you see that sort of connection, then it's like the cost per unit is going to be a lot cheaper for the larger brewery. It's a advertising economies at scale, basically.
You mentioned that a factor in the rise of craft breweries in the United States were changes in some of the tax laws at the federal level. I was wondering if you could expand upon that and talk about some of the other factors at play in terms of why craft brewery has enjoyed such a resurgence and what that says about our changing habits of beer consumption within the United States.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, television ads, this sort of decline in television as the main way to reach viewers or reach an audience has played a big role. Like, I think that the social media, you see there's like a fragmenting of a lot of industries right now. It's not just alcohol, but it's like that trend towards the massive at scale industry that reaches a lot of viewers at the same time is on the decline in a lot of different industries. But let's see, the other changes were just a growing desire for variety. As people's incomes rise, they want greater variety. And in the US for a long time, like the only beers that were even really available were the big three. Those are, I think, are the two main factors in the tax law. And also, I guess I should say just a shift in strategy from small brewers, like I said before. So the first brewer who really identified this was this guy named Fritz Maytag, who is actually heir to the Maytag washing machine fortune. And so he had some money to invest. This is in San Francisco, I think in the 70s. I need to check my numbers. But he went to Stanford and he identified a business opportunity, which is, he says, like you mentioned before, all of the smaller brewers were saying, we need to compete with Budweiser. We're going to cut corners. We're going to get cheaper. We're going to try and compete with them on price. And he said, no, that's the wrong tactic. The only way to compete with them is to differentiate yourself. So he bought a very old brewery that's actually down the street from where I grew up called Anchor Brewery. That's just a very old local brewery in California, and it produced a beer called Steam Beer, which is a style of beer native to California. And Anchor Steam, if you heard of it, this is where I'm going. He was really the first one to identify, like, I'm going to use the best ingredients. I'm going to make this beer really high quality and people are going to pay more. And it grew into, it was pretty much the first modern craft beer in America in recent history, because it grew in popularity because it was different and it was higher end from the Budweiser Miller Coors, and it was from California, and it was able to differentiate itself. And so he kind of established the model for success that all the craft breweries would later follow, like Lagunitas and New Belgium and the ones that really went on to be successful.
You describe how the larger brewers were responding to some of these same trends in the 70s and 80s with trying to develop higher-end beers. You mentioned, for example, Michelob. You also mentioned and how there were some imports, namely Low and Brown Heineken.
Oh, but, yeah.
But I thought it was especially fascinating how this failed attempt to try to bring in high quality European beer and how they just fell flat on their face, and what that said about attitudes and expectations about beer during what turns out to be, in retrospect, this very pivotal turning point in terms of the beer market.
Yeah. So basically for background, basically some of the early attempts of the big three to compete were these super premium beers like Michelob, which were higher end than your standard Budweiser, but basically were created by the same people. And there, in the 80s, the two biggest imports to the U.S. were Heineken and Löwenbräu. And you might be wondering, Löwenbräu, that's weird. I've never heard of them. They were once as big as Heineken in the U.S., and they had like single digit, all of imports were, I think, like 3% market share. I forget the exact number in the U.S. at this point. So it was tiny. But yeah, they began to grow in popularity in the 80s. And what happened was Miller was like, oh, we want to get in on this. Let's compete with Heineken. So they basically established a licensing arrangement with Löwenbräu. But they brewed it in the U.S. in contract brewing. And For those of you, for those listeners who really know their German history, Germans have this law called the Reinheitsgebot, which is dates back to in Munich, 1487. It was just the anniversary this year of this law that basically says there can be three ingredients in beer: water, barley, and hops. This is for bottom fermenting, not so there can be top fermenting wheat beers. That's like an exception. But so basically and the Germans are really serious about their purity law. Like they don't stand for. So Miller was basically advertising Löwenbräu as being brewed in accordance with these high quality German standards, but actually it was being brewed in the US using adjuncts like corn to make it lighter. And AB in, or back then it was Anheuser-Busch, now it's AB InBev, called them out on it and basically made it a huge publicity scandal and nightmare for them. And people started calling it Millerbrau, and it just plummeted. And so I guess it really showed that the U.S. and I think that you still see the roots of it today, because compared to other places in the U.S., there's like a real sensitivity about calling beer imported if it's contract brewed. Like you're not allowed to advertise it as imported. Like Foster's, it's Australian for beer. They are contract brewed in Canada and shipped to the U.S. so they can call themselves imported, because for some reason, it's like the US is the only place in the world that has this kind of mystique around imported as a quality indicator. But yeah, the origins of that I think you can see in the Millerbrau fiasco.
It also points to why they end up buying out these craft breweries is because it seems like they need that cachet, that credibility, because their efforts to establish on their own haven't been very successful so far.
No, yeah. They definitely do. They need a yeah, and it's funny because there's just people like I read blogs and people get so upset about this. And it's kind of like I look at it and I'm like, this is basic economics. Like, do you think that the craft breweries before were, you know, had I mean, obviously they cared about the quality, but they also were trying to make money. And so are the big breweries. But they're, yeah, in the US, I think there's this real kind of paranoia and also this desire for authenticity that is somewhat unique to here.
As you mentioned, beer drinking in the United States, in some respects, has plateaued, but you still see beer drinking expanding globally. You t talk in your book about how it's expanding, as you've already mentioned, in China and Brazil. Russia was an especially interesting case, though, because as you described in the book, we had this that its tradition of vodka drinking and how that had survived it well in. Well, through the communist era. And yet today they're becoming these major beer consumers. What exactly happened there? And what does that say about this interaction between economics and consumption that makes such an important theme of your book?
Well, Russia is a really interesting story, and the researcher who did the research behind that chapter would be the first to tell you that looking into the history of alcohol in Russia is actually very sad, because it's very tied to mortality and like basically very people dying very young, and it's because they have this tradition of spirits drinking and vodka drinking. And basically after the wall came down in 1989, there was this huge increase in the number of deaths, and life expectancy for men went down to like 59. It was crazy, and it was a really volatile time in many ways. Like the economy was undergoing a massive shift in the government, but part of that was just the increase in mortality. So they basically said, okay, we're in this new capitalist economy. We need to figure out the rules. Alcohol, we can't allow advertising for alcohol on TV. because it's, you know, and as I said before, it's like incredible. It was one of the biggest things that surprised me writing this book was, again, how much that the advertising and the media markets affect our consumption habits. And so what happened in Russia was they said you can't allow advertising for alcohol on TV, but beer was not officially categorized as alcohol because its alcohol content was so low. Even like Baltica, Russian beer, it's like 8%. And I think it was under 10% is technically not alcohol. So the breweries really took advantage of this, and they were able to, you saw this massive increase in beer drinking just right at that point. And there are other factors too. Like during that time, there was a lot of foreign direct investment in the supply chains. So there were a lot of companies that came into the former Eastern Bloc and basically said, like, these are going to be important markets. And they bought breweries there. And then they said, oh, we actually need to focus on the entire supply chain. And they invested a lot in barley farms. And they basically made a lot of quality improvements. So there are other factors, but TV was really the big one. And then you saw a kind of a network effect where once a critical mass of people started drinking beer, it really became a habit for people. And there are also some kind of funny components to this where some of the breweries that were taking advantage of this opportune thing would put out ads. They thought like Russian people wouldn't respond well to like beer that they thought was like coming from the West and into Russia. So they created these ads that basically said like beer drinking was Russia's thing all along and the West kind of stole it from us and we're bringing it back. It's actually like this ancient Russian thing, which is not true.
But
like a hockey stick of like really low beer. And then it just explodes. I think it's 94. Probably have to double check that date. And then once they basically took away the TV loophole, it like there's a brief decline and then it kind of plateaus in Russia. But it's still one of the biggest beer markets because it's such a big country, and it really did explode during that point.
And you were alluding just there to something else you mentioned earlier, which is this just how much beer has come to be not a local or regional or even national thing anymore, but it really is now very much of a global thing. How you have with these consolidations, what you might think of as your national beer or your local craft beer is actually part of this beer conglomerate that has a presence, not just in different countries, but in different continents.
Oh yeah. I mean, beer, it's like beer really lends itself to just massive scale because it's, you know, it has very high fixed costs and very low marginal costs. So that always, you know, that's why you see a big industrialization, or really, it was really infected by the Industrial Revolution. And then, yeah, it became now the biggest, the beer conglomerates are like AB InBev is just massive. It brews like, it's like, unless you see this dual market structure where you have these giants and then you have these small craft breweries that are potentially eventually acquired by the giants, is what happened with Heineken and Lagunitas.
Hmm. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
So right now I work for Vox Media with a V, V-O-X. I'm actually on their conferences team, so I work with Recode. Produce Code Conference, so it, like, focus on the tech sector and how tech is influencing commerce and media.
Do you have any books in the works?
No. I think this might be my only book.
Oh, I certainly hope not.
To be totally honest, I just, yeah, it was a lot of work.
Well, Devin, thanks for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us about your book. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.